This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. While he wasn't actually born in Florida, his parents moved to Miami from Chicago when he was two. Jeff Klinkenberg is about as Florida as it gets. He grew up in pre-air-conditioned Miami, fishing in the Everglades and Florida Bay. He wrote his first book about Davy Crockett when he was just six. He graduated from the University of Florida in 1971 and got his first job in journalism at the Miami News, where he worked until moving to what was at the time called the St. Petersburg Times, before becoming the Tampa Bay Times, where he wrote his Real Florida column until retiring in 2013. His new book, Son of Real Florida, is a retrospective of essays that span his life and the people he's met and the places he's visited. While Klinkenberg acknowledges that Florida has a reputation for the weird, he embraces and honors it through his writing. He's won a number of awards for his writing over the years, including the Florida Humanities Council's 2018 Florida Lifetime Achievement Award for writing and the 2018 Florida Folk Heritage Award. His previous books include Alligators in B-Flat, Improbable Tales from the Files of Real Florida, Pilgrim in the Land of Alligators, More Stories About Real Florida, and Seasons of Real Florida. He joins us from his home in St. Pete. Jeff Klinkenberg, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to weigh in on our conversation, you can make a comment on our social media. Find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I want to ask you first, what does the phrase Real Florida mean to you deep down at this point in your life?
It means authentic Florida. What are the things that make Florida, Florida? And certainly, we have a pop culture, but I'm usually thinking other than pop culture that, related, to climate, to critters, to food, to music, to art, things like that. But what does it mean to be a Floridian? And that's how I, when I started writing that column, that's how I sort of framed it for myself. So I probably wasn't going to write about theme parks or Disney World. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. They're part of our Florida's popular culture, but I was looking for something a little bit, deeper and, in my mind, a little more authentic.
Did you find it difficult to find real Florida in the sea of so many transplants from other parts of the country? I mean, is there a real Florida?
Well, yes, there is. It is a little harder to find those things now than, say, when I was a boy in the 50s, when only rich people had air conditioning. You felt it. It was coming through your open windows, the heat, I joke that, my mother lived in terror of going into the kitchen at night and turning on the light for fear of what she might see, in the silverware drawers.
Yeah. I get that.
I could hear owls, hooting from the poinciana tree outside my bedroom window. So what I think of as real Florida just sort of slapped you in the face back then. It was just, you were surrounded by it. So it's changed over the years. I mean, suddenly we all had air conditioning. Our front porches sort of disappeared. But that doesn't mean real Florida disappeared. It was still there, and it still is. Again, though, it takes a little effort, I think, And if you are stuck in this narrative that Florida is the weird capital of the world, you probably are going to miss, some of the delights and some of the other things that are here just waiting for you to look for them. A lot of people don't get off the interstate. A lot of people don't go, live in big cities and don't leave. A lot of people don't explore the foods and the culture and the art that's right there in front of them, So I always kind of thought of myself as a contemporary William Bartram. And Bartram was a Pennsylvanian who in the 1700s made an expedition through the South which included a big Florida leg. And he wrote about what he was finding. It was he was writing natural history. He was writing about the native people he was finding. He was writing kind of nitty gritty stuff, but also he was thrilled with what he was seeing. So there was a transcendental aspect to that. But what he became an interpreter of this new land. And while his work wasn't necessarily embraced in North America, it was in other parts of the world. And his book, Travels, published in 1791, it's still in print. And then after that, there were people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, who after writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, started to spend winters in Florida, and she started to do the same thing. She was in this, what she considered a paradise, and she was writing magazine stories for the world about what she was finding, good and bad, I might add.
So you're kind of a continuation of this legacy, really.
That's how I feel about it. Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, Zora Neale Hurston, there, at least since the 1700s, there was somebody like me doing this work.
So you mentioned earlier, you mentioned earlier a little bit about your mom being afraid to go into the kitchen in the middle of the night and turning on the light and seeing what she found in the silverware drawer, which I 100% can relate to. How was it for your parents? I mean, you moved down here when you were two. They came from Chicago. Did you see them struggling to adjust to life in a non-air-conditioned Florida back then?
Well, yes, in a way. My mother was B, and my dad was Ernie, and he was a musician before the war, and then, you know, after he got back from overseas, he tried to be a musician, tried to be a piano player, and thought that Florida was going to be a place for a new start. There might be less competition. My mother was a city woman through and through, and they move in June 1951. Rainy season has commenced. It feels like you're the atmosphere is like Venus. It's just thick and humid. And my mother says, "Ernie, what have you done to me?" moving her there. But what my mother had, and she, you know, my mother, Beatrice Mary Grace O'Donnell, she had those Irish genes and the Irish virtues of being extremely curious. And my mom could walk out on the street and go down her block in Miami and come back an hour later smoking that Pall Mall hanging from her lip. And she'd come in the house and she'd put that cigarette out in the Dunkin' grapefruit she'd had for breakfast and said, "Well, let me tell you what I found out." And she would dish on all the neighbors. She'd spin stories about what she had seen. And, you know, I'm a little boy. I'm listening to that. So I grew up listening to a woman who could tell stories. And my dad, on the other hand, was quieter, but he loved Florida from the beginning. He loved to fish. He loved to camp. He loved to do all that stuff. So we would do that. And one of my earliest memories is of him. He liked to do these open water swims on Miami Beach, and when I was old enough, I could grab the back of his trunks. I had my own little mask and snorkel, and we'd swim along the beach, and it was like being in a giant aquarium. So that was an imprint on me. And then you mentioned, my first book, Davy Crockett and the Alligators. I was a Florida boy. I was a Florida kid, and there were lots of people like that then. They're mostly boys, but certainly girls too, who just, you know, we kind of lived and breathed it. We didn't think of ourselves as anything special, but that's just how it was. You know, we were down at the canal. We were making rafts. We were jumping off the bridge. We were doing all these things that could get us killed.
Yeah.
We were drinking out of mud puddles. I can still see the oil sheen on top yet I'm still here.
I think a lot of us look back at our childhood and wonder how we survived much of it. But surviving childhood in Florida is a little more extreme.
Exactly, yes. And, you know, the snakes, and we didn't see, you know, you didn't see many alligators when I was a kid because they'd been really, diminished by legal and illegal hunting. But every once in a while you would, and it was like, holy God, you know, we live with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So a lot of those things I've never gotten over, you know. I'm still thrilled when I see an alligator or a crocodile or a snake. I'm still a little bit snake crazy, to be honest. I don't go out of my way to catch them like I did when I was a teenager, but I've always, you know, it's always cool when I see one, because and the reason why is it tells me that Florida is still here, you know.
Very much so.
I'm thrilled, you know, whenever there's a panther sighting down in Southwest Florida, or you know, a bear crosses the road and somebody, you know, sees it. That tells me that Florida is still here. 21 million of us now, 21 million people here. There were about 2 or 3 million when I was a kid. And yet, you know, what real Florida still hangs on. And I think that's pretty cool. And it was, you know, it was just a wonderful thing to be able to write about.
Well, you started writing as a journalist with the Miami newspaper. And so, I mean, it's not really surprising that you went into journalism with such a great Paul Molswilly, a storyteller of a mom. and then your dad, who embraced Florida and the life here. So it's not really so shocking that you became a journalist. What do you remember about that part of your life, covering it from a news perspective instead of as a teenager chasing down snakes?
Well, it was one time many years ago, I think it was 1977, I covered this bass fishing tournament, back when bass fishing tournaments were becoming big. They were being televised, you know, they were getting a lot of press. And I asked this guy who had started this phenomenon of bass fishing tournaments how he had felt when he understood the potential of this endeavor. And he said, "Well, son, I was like an alligator, and I was like a blind dog in a smokehouse. I was wheeling and dealing." And I thought later, God, that's the greatest quote I've ever heard, number one. And number two, that's me. I'm like a blind dog in a smokehouse, because everywhere you snap, you come up with something meaty. There's all these stories that are waiting to be told, and maybe they were told by Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings in the 30s or 40s, but they really haven't been told for a long time, and they're just here. It's low-hanging fruit, if you're curious. And again, that's the gift I got from my mom, was being curious, wondering, what were you thinking? Why did you do that? Having this feeling that everybody had a story to tell. And in my case, you know, some of those people, the story they had to tell was the time they were bitten by a cottonmouth, or finding a bee tree or something like that. And these were real stories. There was this whole other world of politics and crime and these other things that are also important, but then there was this other, and I kind of liked writing about the other.
That ended up being defined as real Florida, right?
Yes. There's a historian, and I guess he was a philosopher too, named Will Durant, and he wrote a book called History of Civilization, and I'm going to paraphrase him here, but He said, history is like a stream, and in the middle of the stream is the politics, the wars, the crime, all those things that historians and journalists write about. But he said the banks of the stream is where real life is happening, and that's where people are being born and dying, and they're writing poetry, and they're whittling, and, you know, they're canoeing, and they're screaming at alligators and stuff. And that's sort of, you know, I kind of like to focus on what was happening on the banks.
That's that day-to-day stuff. And the day-to-day stuff in real Florida is different from day-to-day stuff in other places.
It is. You know, we're not Manhattan. My wife is from New York. And I used to tell her, you know, you can be mugged in Manhattan, but you won't be devoured by wild beasts. You know, you don't have dinosaurs in Central Park.
And
you do in, you know, my Yucca River State Park.
So you ended up doing a column called Real Florida. After you were working as a journalist in Miami, you ended up going over to St. Pete, working for what was then the St. Petersburg Time, later became the Tampa Bay Times, and you started writing this column called Real Florida. How did you evolve into being able to do that? It's kind of – the world is short on great reporters. Were they able to shift you over into a column pretty easily?
Yes, and part of it is, and you know, this is just how it works anywhere, but I had some other opportunities to go other places, you know, and do different kinds of writing, and the St. Pete Times wanted to keep me, and they said, what would you like to do? And I said, I would like to do this. And I grew up, you know, in Miami, and there was a writer there at the Miami Herald who I admired greatly. His name was Al Burt, and he wrote a column. It was just called Al Burt's Florida back in the 70s and the early 80s, and I always liked it. It was 800, maybe 1,000 words. Al had some physical challenges related to something had happened to him in the 70s. So, you know, a lot of his reporting was sitting on a front porch and talking to somebody. But he wrote beautifully and elegantly. And I thought, you know, I'd love to try this. I'm able-bodied. I can go in the canoe. I can go into a cave. You know, I can drive anywhere I want and talk to people and stuff. I'd like to do that. And Al was getting ready to retire. He was just very encouraging because he wanted this to continue, this tradition that had started with William Bartram. And I should tell you that, you know, when I was a kid, lots of newspapers had people like me. Magazines had people like me who were interpreting Florida for all these people who were moving into the state. Especially after the war, who were telling people, you know, what's that snake you saw back by the garbage can, you know, whatever, or what are those birds, you know, you're hearing, what's that, why, what are grits?
Yeah, and there's an endless stream of newcomers to share that with.
Exactly. And so you had these newcomers reading those, but you also had these old timers reading these things to see if, well, maybe I can catch somebody in a mistake.
Yeah, see if you get it right.
exactly, yeah. And then I can call them and, you know, and say, and you thought you were smart.
Yeah, you know? I love those guys.
and you went to college, you know, so you'd always get that stuff. So there was this long tradition, and you know, Al had done it, and then I continued it. And sad to say, you know, with the what's happened to newspapers, and I don't know if it's going to continue to tell the truth. Sometimes it does. Sometimes I see things, interestingly, in food stories that I think of as Florida culture stories. You know, they might be about oranges or the food writer at the Tampa Bay Times, Laura Riley, today had a story about beekeeping.
Yeah, there's a lot of culture in the food stories.
Exactly. But the kind of things that I sort of like to do, just can't be done today because, you know, there's the newspaper staffs are smaller by 90%.
Yeah, and you have to have a writer that's probably dedicated to doing it on the side while still also being a full-time reporter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if somebody gets bitten by an alligator or whatever, that's going to be in the – that'll be publicized. And it's really easy. You know, it doesn't take much effort to do these real Florida stories, these Florida man stories. They're just everywhere. I mean, you can see them on the Twitter feed.
The viral Florida man. I mean, it seems like they're just one after the other. And is it really just Florida? I mean, what's that about?
It isn't just Florida. In fact, you know, if you Googled weird Montana, you would find that I'll bet you $1 million there's a weird Montana page or weird Rhode Island or weird Utah. I mean, every state has one.
Yeah, they're probably not Delaware, though. You don't really hear much about Delaware. I'm just kidding.
As soon as we hang up, I'm going to look and see if I can find one in Delaware. You know, Delaware man, I don't know, was seen running naked down Main Street. You know, and it only happens in Delaware. Mm-hmm. But some of it's funny, and you know, I'm a huge fan of Carl Hiaasen, who was one of the first people to mine that. But he did it as a novelist and as a satirist, and he's brilliant at it, and I enjoy it a whole lot. But you know, when it sort of becomes the nonfiction narrative, I start to squirm a little bit. It's like blonde jokes or Polish jokes or whatever. After a while, I think, come on, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway,
it gets old after a little bit.
What a cantankerous old man I've become.
I know. Get off my lawn, right?
Exactly. You know. So anyway.
Getting more serious, though, I mean, I'd love, you had contact with Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and you even met her and wrote about her. Can you tell me a little bit about what she was like? I mean, there are some people who may know the name but not the person. What did she mean to Florida and to you?
Well, you know, a couple months ago when we had the tragedy in Broward County at a school named after her, there were a couple of days where, you know, like everybody else, I'm reading the coverage, and it just occurred to me, well, you know, nobody seems to know who Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was, or very few people did, even in Florida. You know, sometimes in Florida, you know, ancient history is what happened 5 years ago, and she died in I want to say 1998. Mm-hmm. And so... you know, I ended up contributing to a story that was in the Washington Post. Finally, the Post did a story about who was Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. And, you know, I put some stuff up on Facebook and, you know. But when I was growing up, everybody knew who Marjorie Stoneman Douglas was. She was in a smaller Miami. She was kind of a celebrity. And she just had this fascinating history of, you know, born in 1890. I want to say she was from Connecticut or New Hampshire. And she moves to Miami in 1915 after a divorce to work at her daddy's newspaper, the Miami Herald. She's on the women's pages back then, and everything that implies, writing about, bridge clubs and gardening clubs and doilies or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And she said, Daddy, I'm as good as anybody else. I want to write real news. And so she did. So she was a feminist before anybody had ever heard of that word. She was interested in the Everglades. There were some people down there who were trying to get the federal government to declare the Everglades a national park. It took a long time. She was not an outdoors person. She much preferred the rattle of ice in a glass of scotch than the cry of the great blue herons. But she was interested, and she'd go out there with friends on picnics before the Tamiami Trail was completed. So in 1940, she gets a call from a publisher who's publishing books. It's called the Rivers of America series, and they were hiring writers all over the country to write about the Mississippi, the Ohio River,
Colorado, yeah.
And she publisher said, "Well, why don't you write one about the Miami River?" And she said, "Well, you know, the Miami River is an inch long. How about I write about the Everglades?" And this guy says, "Well, madam, you know, the Everglades is not a river." And she said, "Well, yes, it is. It's a river of grass. It's 50 miles wide, and it's 10 inches deep. It flows north to south, and I can tell that story." And she did. Published in 1947, the same year that the Everglades became a national park. It's the only one of the Rivers of America books that is still in print. So she's 58 when that happens. You know, she's not, you know, 38 or 28. Mm-hmm. She's 58. You think, okay, well, she just wrote the Bible on the Everglades. She can retire now. She can, you know, if she wants to garden, she can do that. If she wants to travel, she can travel, blah, blah, blah. She's earned it. But she's got all these friends who see things happening in the Everglades development. Somebody wants to build a jet port out there. And they say, "Marjorie, you got to do something about it." She says, "Oh, you know, I'm too tired. I don't want to do anything." And her friends say, "Well, you got to. You're the one. You have authority." So she formed a group called the Friends of the Everglades, and they stopped that jet port. And I want to say she was 78, 80 when that happened.
Wow.
And continued to be very active. And I had never met her, but in the late 80s, I started to correspond with her. Whenever I wrote something about the Everglades, I would send it to her. And, you know, she was a 19th century person. She would always write back these polite letters. And in 1992, I decided to do this series of essays about the Everglades using Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi as my model, where I was going to start up in the Kissimmee Valley, where the Everglades begins, and then work my way down to Florida Bay. And I thought, you know, it'd really be cool if I could, the first piece of this, the first essay, could be on Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, you know, who had been an idol and who had put the Everglades on the national map. Mm-hmm. So I called her up and I went down there in 1992. She was 102, and she spoke in perfect paragraphs, tiny, wearing pearls. I thought I'd be there for an hour or two. I ended up being there for about 5 hours. And she was virtually deaf and virtually blind. She had hearing aids. She had an aide who would yell in her ear. You know, I would ask her a question. He would yell in her ear, and then pretty soon I would yell in his ear, and he would yell back at her. It was kind of, but we had a great time, and except for this one moment where I thought, well, I'm gonna impress her. I'm gonna impress Mrs. Douglas with my Everglades creds, and talk and tell her about being on a couple of panther captures. The state and federal government are capturing panthers, and they're putting radio collars on them so they can tell, you know, how panthers are traveling down there. So I tell her, and she says, "Wow!" And she was very aristocratic sounding. She said, "Well, that sounds to me like the utmost cruelty." And I sort of backtracked. I said, "Well, Mrs. Douglas, here's why they're doing it. Science, blah, 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 blah." She says, "My cat Willie doesn't even like flea collars." And it turned out she was like the ultimate cat person. And, you know, I'm sitting in this little English cottage in Coconut Grove, and I start noticing all the cat doors. She was feeding all the neighborhood strays. They come in her house to be fed and stuff. And I tried to explain one more time, and she says, "Lord have mercy," like she was dealing with the the world's biggest idiot. So, you know, we continued to correspond after that. And, you know, she died when she was 108 years old. I mean, she was, you know, she was ready to go. We had stopped, I guess maybe she stopped responding to my letters maybe when she was 104, 105. You know, she was just too tired and sleepy. But yeah. She lived a long time after that. But the thing about, you know, the massacre in Broward County, I was hearing people say, who knew something about Mrs. Douglas, well, she must be spinning in her grave. And I thought about that. And of course, she would be appalled at what had happened. But on the other hand, I thought she would just be electrified by those students who weren't going to just despair, who were going to take their despair and make it into some kind of positive and not be afraid of the National Rifle Association, like sometimes their parents and politicians were. They were going to take the fight. And that's what Douglas did with the Everglades. You know, people were saying, well, you know, it's progress. We're going to drain the Everglades. And Douglas said, no, you know, that's our water supply. It's a world treasure, you know. And I think she just loved those students.
Yeah.
Who stood up.
If you're just joining the show, I'm talking with author and journalist Jeff Klinkenberg on today's show. His new book, Son of Real Florida, was recently published by the University Press of Florida. And if you'd like to weigh in on our conversation, you can make a comment on our social media by finding us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or we're on Twitter at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. I want to ask you a little bit about the book. Can you tell me a little about it?
Well, it's a collection of essays. Some go way back, some don't. It's much more personal than anything I'd written before, and especially the things about my parents, who were like many parents, including me. You know, they had their strengths and they had their flaws. And so I kind of get into that. My mom coming from a dysfunctional alcoholic family, and my dad coming from a kind of a histrionic family who tried to kind of hold his emotions in check, who would explode every once in a while. And, you know, I would get beaten. with a belt to a point of bruising and bleeding and all that stuff. And so there's essays of me, you know, trying to come to terms with that and deciding, you know what, I've got to forgive here, you know, for reasons that include my own things that, you know, my own flaws. but yet, you know, there were these wonderful things that my parents did. They loved me. They loved my brother. They gave me some gifts. And so, you know, you right off the bat, you're kind of hit with that, those. And you know, we talked about how the heck did we manage to survive, you know, as kids. And
yeah,
there was an essay about a kid, a friend of mine, who didn't survive. I was with him when he died. We had trespassed. We had climbed a fence of a golf course in Miami and fishing in a place where we weren't supposed to fish. And there was a terrible tragedy, and he lost his life. So you have things like that in there. And then you have lots of joyful things and interesting people that I got to meet. But, you know, the one thing I tried to do with that column over many years was I tried to reflect real life, and it wasn't always sweet. You know, there was certainly some bittersweet and some plain dark in some of the stories I wrote. I always said that I could write about anything through the prism of Florida, including murder, you know, and crime, and you know, there's a piece, there's an essay on a guy named Jack Murphy, who was a convicted jewel thief and a murderer, and who was an icon in Miami when I was growing up, and I discovered he was still alive, and ended up writing about him. So,
who are some of the more interesting characters that you did come across over the course of your career? Are there any that stand out?
There's a million who.
It's hard to pick, right?
It's hard to pick. You know, I've been in conjunction with this new book, I've been doing lots of talks all over the state about interesting people that I knew. Hopefully, I'm going to get. I think I have something coming up in Marco Island, and next year anyway. And I hope I get something up down in Fort Myers and Naples and in the near future. But I've done about 20 of these talks since March. And so I have Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is on my list, and the Highwaymen, the African-American painters from Fort Pierce who started in the 50s, and some of them are still going. I was among the first to rediscover them in the 1990s, a civil rights story and an art story. And I have a Highwayman story in my new book. In fact, it's about the only female highwayman, Marianne Carroll, in her 70s now. I knew, here's one that people enjoy hearing about. I'll tell this story this way. So in 1968, I was the sports editor at Miami-Dade Junior College, the newspaper, and this big guy walked in the office one day. He's dressed from camouflage from head to toe. He says to me, "I want to write about hunting and fishing," in kind of a pugnacious way. He's like, he's a little too close to me. He's towering over me. And he says, you know, he's talking like, you know, maybe I'm some city boy who would know nothing about fishing or hunting. And I wasn't a hunter, but I knew a lot about fishing. So I said, yes, let's do that. So my joke is, you know, during the age of Aquarius, we were the only college newspaper in the country that had an outdoors editor. And that guy was, his name was Tim Chapman, and he ended up working at the Miami Herald for 40 years as a wonderful photographer. He was sort of the gonzo photographer of Florida. He was somebody that the Herald sent to all the flashpoints on Earth, where the wars were happening, the earthquakes, the terrible hurricanes. He was kind of a tough ass. And he had grown up just like me, as kind of a swamp boy in the Everglades and the Miami area and in the Keys and stuff. And we stayed in touch over those many years. And I guess back in the, 2007 or 6, somewhere in there, Tim called and said, "Hey, I want you to come and see my house in the Keys. I've been working on this house for 25 years, building it a little at a time. Tim can do anything." So he had done that. But So I went down there and I decided, you know what? Tim is such an interesting person. I mean, he eats roadkill. He's kind of a, you know, he's a gun guy. When he was a teenager, I mean, he was sawing down billboards, you know, because they were promoting development and all kinds of stuff. It'd be fun to write about him. And his best friend is Carl Hiaasen.
I can kind of now that you say that, I can kind of feel like I see his character in some of those books.
Well, exactly. I mean, he's Skink. Tim is Skink, you know, and Carl will tell you that, you know, Skink is sort of a combination of characters, but Tim is sort of the scary, dangerous guy, you know.
No, it sounds like you're describing this character. I was like, I know that guy.
Yeah, oh, I mean, there's millions of Tim Chapman stories. Mm-hmm. And so he's retired, he lives in the Keys, I'm proud to call him my scariest friend. But so Tim Chapman, and you know, there's so many, there's just lots of people like that. I mean, I knew someone told me one time, you know, that little girl who was in the Coppertone ad, she's still with us. She lives in Ocala, you know? So I take some effort to find out who she is. And I call her and I say, hey, you know, it's Jeff Klingenberg. I grew up looking at those Coppertone ads, you know, in Miami when I was a kid. I'd love to write about you. And there's this terrible silence that writers hate to, hate silence.
It's not going to end well.
And she says, oh no, you're not going to write about that. I said, well, why? It's great. It's blah, 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 blah. You're an icon. She says, no, don't write about me. Write about my mother and her mother. And I'm thinking, oh no, you know, when someone says write about my mother, I'm thinking, okay, you know, is this somebody who's writing cat poetry?
I know. All these things. Quilting nationalist.
Exactly. So, but her mother was this artist who had actually done the Coppertone ad, among many others, and was one of the premier cheesecake calendar artists starting in the 1940s. And so she was living in Ocala, and I went up and spent a great day with her, Joyce Ballantyne Brand.
Did you have any cheesecake?
I didn't have any cheesecake, but I tell you, I was afraid I wasn't going to escape there with my honor. I mean, she wanted to go out for martinis, but she was just something, you know. And there probably is no ad in Florida as iconic.
Oh, yeah.
As that ad, you know. So anyway, I knew Joyce. I did this for so long. I'm going to be 69 in a couple of weeks. I just managed to stumble across people like that.
Yeah, those are great finds.
Through the years.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time, but before I let you go, I want to ask something that my producer wrote in here. He said, ask about the mom's recipe for American spaghetti.
Oh, man. Well, I don't know. I usually charge big bucks, too. Well, my mother, my mother grew up very poor, and her mother, who was born in 1885, Josie O'Donnell, had to come up with recipes, especially during the Depression, because my mother and her siblings did miss meals. Grandma Josie had this recipe that she called, I'm not sure what she called it, but it was just it was something that was designed to give a longer life to ground beef. So it was ground beef sauteed with onions and garlic with a can of tomatoes added to it and maybe some green pepper, chopped up and served on top of that, and then poured over macaroni. And so I grew up with that when I was a kid. My mother called it American spaghetti. Not because it was spaghetti, but I think because I liked spaghetti and I was a picky eater, and she knew I would eat it if she called it American spaghetti. So I grew up with that. It's still my comfort food.
Early branding.
Exactly. My kids ate it. My grandkids eat it now. In different parts of America, I mean, it can be known as American goulash. In New England, it's American chop suey. I've actually found it on menus in Florida called cracker goulash.
Oh.
So it's just kind of this interesting thing. So it is my comfort food, and maybe after we're finished with this conversation and I look up Weird Delaware, I may have to make myself a pot of American spaghetti.
For what it's worth, my producer did call up a story and sent it to me while we were talking. Video arrest of naked man in Wilmington goes viral. So there is Weird Delaware.
I tell you what, you know.
It exists.
So it sounds like we're pretty, you know, life is pretty calm here. You know, we do have the alligators in the swimming pools. But other than that, it's pretty calm.
That is paradise. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. That's all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Jeff Klingenberg. He's an award-winning journalist and author. His new book, Son of Real Florida, was recently published by the University Press of Florida. Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your time and your stories with us today, and also that stellar recipe for American spaghetti.
Oh, you know, you really won the... You won the lotto with this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida. Thank you.